Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Sarah Lazar, reporter and web editor for In These Times magazine, joins me to discuss how pharmaceutical companies are threatening desperate nations with retaliation if those nations choose to support vaccine waivers, waivers that would make vaccines more globally equitable, but would cut into Big Pharma's profits.
And Heather Digby Parton will help us break down all the top news items of the week. Hey, folks, don't forget you can become a member of this program and support this show by going to ROFpodcast.com. When you do, I think you know by now what happens. You not only support the free show, you get extra content. Today on the program, for extra content, my interview with David Wallace Wells. He is a writer with New York Magazine, and he has dug deep into COVID over the past year and a half. And he's a great guy to talk to about this stuff. And he writes that our children have been safe from COVID, largely speaking, and continue to be safe even as we are facing the latest variant, that being the Delta variant. Now, he's not a denialist at all. He's just looking at the science and the data. And it is encouraging, I gotta say, someone who has a young child who is not vaccinated, I found this to be a fairly comforting interview with David Wallace Wells. That said, my kid still masks up when he goes into public spaces. Very, I think, a legitimate thing to do. But if you're like me and you have some anxiety about that, you're going to want to listen to this. And you can, as a member of the show, just head to ROFpodcast.com. As always, thank you for your support. So, Heather, a lot to talk about this week in our politics, and it's weird. It's rather strange. I had not necessarily, I guess, if you had asked me in December of 2020, what will we be talking about 7-8 months into the Biden administration, I might have said something like the infrastructure bill. I hope I would have. Of course, I didn't know it was going to happen with the Senate, but in Georgia at that time. But this whole dynamic with Trump and January 6th and the Republicans unable or unwilling to pivot away from Donald Trump is fascinating. And so let's start there. We've had some pretty dramatic testimony at the beginning of the January 6th commission. And just to remind people, this is a select committee that has only two Republicans, I guess, rhinos on some level, if you were a Republican at this point, who are sitting on it because Kevin McCarthy had appointed five. Two of them were people who may be material witnesses, and so they're not appropriate for the committee. They were rejected by Nancy Pelosi, and McCarthy not only pulled all of those people, he's also pulled all of the Republican members of the Select Committee on Equity in Economics, which, of course, I'm surprised that they put anybody on that in the first place, but nevertheless, here we are. So, I mean, give me your sense of what struck you about those hearings this week and how they resonated.
Well, I think, you know, they were very dramatic. And it's like, you know, with the descriptions of the, you know, what happened that day. I mean, obviously, we all watched it in real time and we knew a lot of this, but hearing it from those guys all sitting there in their uniforms testifying was pretty powerful stuff. And it felt like what we were talking about was kind of a medieval form of hand-to-hand combat that was going on that day. From their perspective, they were out there, you know, and nobody was firing guns, although, you know, the police certainly had access to guns if the protesters didn't. So in a way, it's kind of amazing that it wasn't a lot worse, and tells you just how much restraint they actually showed in that situation. I felt like the hearings were done quite well. It was nice not to have the Republicans shouting, screaming, making jokes, interrupting, doing the usual stuff that they would do. And I think Pelosi, I think that to me, it just reinforced the fact that she made the right decision in kind of pushing that when McCarthy put those people on there as a poison pill. I think she knew they'd probably withdraw all of his, all of the Republicans. I think she probably knew that would happen. It seems logical that that would happen. So, you know, I felt like it resonated, you know, strongly with a good part of the country. Unfortunately, of course, on the right-wing media, they were immediately making fun of the cops and fun of, you know, and mocking the whole situation. You know, in other words, just being crude jerks as usual. And, you know, it reminds me of when you just said this in your introduction here. If you'd have told us a year ago that, you know, this would be going on, if you'd have told me 10 years ago that the right wing would be, you know, turning on the police and basically making a mockery of, you know, the police trying to repel an attack on the United States Capitol, I would have said you were crazy, because I, in those days, believed that there was at least some small fiber of actual principles involved in the Republican and that conservative movement. And support for the police was one of them. It just wouldn't have occurred to me that there would be a circumstance in which they would turn on the cops, but they did. I mean, it's clear the stuff that they're saying on the right wing is that these police were, you know, they're all weaklings. They're all, you know, they're betrayers of the country. They're unpatriotic and all that stuff. And that's just crazy time, you know, that's just nuts.
I mean, that is, they're also, I think we're seeing a lot of people saying that they're lying. They want to see the body cam footage. Like, I mean, it is, we still hear a lot of talk of they just let them in, which is, I mean, I think I can understand why there are some people who feel like the Democrats are using this too much, or being too dramatic about it. I don't necessarily agree with that take, but it's within the realm of, you know, an opinion on, you know, the politics of this. And, you know, I'm not surprised to see politicians use hyperbole in the description of these things, right? I mean, that is fairly a banal analysis of politics, in my opinion. But to claim still that there's something up fishy because the police let them in, and certainly I think, like, you know, the first couple of days afterwards, there was like, what happened here? Did they just let them in? There's sufficient footage now to see that they were overrun. And to the extent that they let people in, it was a tactical retreat, if you will.
Exactly.
You know, there was really not much choice. It was either that or get bludgeoned. And in some instances, you know, worse. Obviously, I think it was a smart move to open up with that type of testimony, right? Because that shows the stakes and sort of the brutality that was involved in this, and the idea that it was just sort of like, well, it was like a protest. It wasn't a protest. I mean, let's be clear. It wasn't. And from the very beginning, and what we're starting to hear about Mo Brooks now, who the DOJ, and this is interesting too, because just to remind people, Eric Swalwell is suing Mo Brooks for his potential incitement. Involving, you know, Mo Brooks spoke at the Stop the Steal rally steps from where the Capitol was. And Swalwell has standing, is suing for that incitement. And apparently Mo Brooks, you know, was attempting to get the DOJ to defend him as if he was doing this in the course of the duty of Congress. And the DOJ has decided, no, sorry, that's not going to fly. It's important because it gives us a slight sense of the potential for the Department of Justice to be a little more aggressive. And I say that's important because, Mo Brooks said that he had body armor on when he gave that speech.
Right.
And Mo Brooks said that he slept in his office, not his in his normal condo because something was going to happen. And he was forewarned, you know, a couple of days before. Now, that's really interesting because that does not jibe with the idea that this just was a spontaneous thing and people were riled up and it wasn't anything anybody said in particular. Plus, we also know there's been congressmen, Republican congressmen who knew something was up that morning of the, you know, at the hotel type of thing. The point being that this committee, select committee, is not doing voluntary. They're not asking people to voluntarily come in and give testimony. They're going right to compulsion.
Yeah.
Compulsion means nothing unless the Department of Justice decides to back up that compulsion mm-hmm. with some type of sanction, right? Prosecution, whatnot. That didn't happen when Donald Trump controlled the Department of Justice. There's a reason, you know, to question whether Merrick Garland was going to do anything because they haven't done anything. Maybe they're letting Congress, you know, dictate this. But it's important to note that the DOJ may uphold some subpoenas. And, you know, there's a reason why Mo Brooks wore a body armor that day. And I think the American public should know why. I don't. And, you know, it's interesting. He's admitting that he wore body armor. He's not saying exactly why. That's a weird thing to do at a rally.
Very. And by the way, there were a bunch of people in the crowd wearing body armor, as we know, and, you know, with zip ties and all kinds of things. And you're right. It's very important that the DOJ did that. And we weren't sure they were going to, because they did defend Donald Trump in a similar sort of situation, using the same legal, you know, sort of underpinning that Mo Brooks was trying to use, which is to say this was in the course of his duty as a congressman, was being there that day at that rally. And therefore, you can't sue me. I'm representing the U.S. government. You can only sue the U.S. government for that. And the DOJ has said that Donald Trump could do that in the case of E. Jean Carroll, who she sued him for defamation. And they said, well, it was in the course of his duty. I think that was a crazy decision. But, you know, regardless, it was kind of scary because it sounded as though they might agree that these people doing these kind of weird, you know, hyper partisan, you know, incitement sorts of things were doing things in the course of, you know, they would make that decision. So this was important that they did this. And that is part of, I think it's really important that the committee is going there. I mean, I think they're going to call Jim Jordan. It certainly sounds like it, because he said he had finally admitted this week that he was talking to Donald Trump on January 6th, which he had not admitted to before. And he'll probably claim some kind of privilege, but it doesn't exist for him in this situation. And so what was going on that day and what was going on in the days before? One of the books that came out recently, I don't remember if it was, you know, I Alone Can Fix It or which one of these books about the final days, which said that, you know, Trump was on the phone day in and day out with Rudy Giuliani, and they were plotting January 6th. There was a lot of planning. Let's just put it that way. We don't know how much. We don't know who was involved. We don't know how far down into the, you know, the bowels of the Trump, you know, following all of this stuff. But we do know, like you said, there were meetings at the hotel in D.C. They had pictures on Instagram of them all meeting together and talking with people who were in the crowd the next day. So this is the kind of thing that I think that they have to get to. And they have to get to the fact that Donald Trump didn't respond, and which, needless, why would he? If this was in the realm of his, you know, I mean, he was obviously excited and happy about it. But, you know, let's just put it this way. If he wasn't surprised that this happened, he would not have been inclined to do anything about it until it became absolutely necessary and he had no choice. So this is very important. And I think that it's interesting that they've decided to do the hearings now. It's, you know, the Watergate hearings took place in August. everybody, you know, there was a lot of, it was, politics were kind of doldrums. You know, it was one of those times where this was really the focus. I think that's smart. And I hope that the networks cover it thoroughly. I watched it on NBC, which cut away from the Olympics to show it. Granted, it was in the daytime, but that was, you know, I thought that was a nice patriotic move on the part of NBC to do that, you know. So, you know, this is hopefully going to somehow penetrate at least some part of the country that insists that, you know, it's, I mean, some people will never change, but there have to be some apathetic types of people in the middle who come to understand what really happened.
All right. So, okay. So let's look at this. There's two way lenses in which you can look at this. They're not mutually exclusive, but one is the importance of holding people to account for this type of thing, because even if you don't think this was, second only to the Civil War in terms of the precariousness of our government, and I would suggest that, you know, we had some pretty nasty sort of conspiracies and potential coups during FDR's presidency, who knows what else? I mean, there was, Kennedy had some friction with the deep state at that time as well. But even if you don't think it's the second most or the third most or the fourth most, I mean, this is something that you'd want to make sure that there's some accountability for, because, you're setting the boundaries of what is appropriate response to an election, and you wouldn't want it to be overrun the Capitol. I mean, you just wouldn't want that to be. You know, as long as you overrun the Capitol and then leave, and no harm, no foul. Like, you wouldn't want that in a functioning democracy. Then the other question is, as a political matter, as a political matter, does this make sense for the Democrats to pursue? And it seems to me, and you wrote a piece this week that was sort of, tangentially, I think, related to this, which was Donald Trump is insisting on inserting himself. And maybe that's even the wrong way of saying it. I mean, Donald Trump is still the most prominent Republican political figure that we have in the country. And he has decided that he is not in retirement. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about the implications of that, because the January 6th thing feeds into this.
Right.
Both from in terms of like what it means for Republicans, but also for Democrats. And we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back and talk about this, because this is a really fascinating dynamic, I believe. And it dovetails, too, with the infrastructure bill and with the COVID relief bills. Mm-hmm. And some of the reporting that is happening around that, which is fascinating and in some respects depressing in some ways. But we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. So, Heather, we've been talking about the January 6th Select Committee, and, we are moving on to the sort of like the political implications of it. This is going to go through August. There could be some testimony that is, pretty intense. We've seen some intense testimony this week, but we could see some sort of like stuff that is, there could be some people who are involved in some type of plot, as sort of ham-fisted and Keystone Cops-ish as it is, still not something a functional democracy wants to sort of say, like, don't worry about it. We can have politicians who are conspiring. As long as they're incompetent, we'll be fine. that's not something you want to be just hanging out there. So the question at this point is, how does this play out in terms of politics? And you wrote a great piece this week in Salon about Donald Trump's essentially, not going into retirement. And I'm increasingly, convinced that if I had to bet money, it would really be between, choosing, do I want to bet that Donald Trump has a physical ailment that prevents him from running for president, or he's going to be the nominee? I mean, it's hard to imagine someone else coming up and being the nominee, because everybody's trying to be a Donald Trump, light in that party. And people are going to go with the real deal, as it were. There's a fascinating dynamic that's developing because we saw Donald Trump again, and this is not, we saw a lot of this during his presidency. Even he backs a candidate. There was a special election in Texas for a Republican congressman who had died of COVID. Apparently it exists. And Donald Trump backed one candidate, apparently was convinced to do so by the Club for Growth. The Republican establishment in Texas backed the other candidate. Trump's candidate lost. And but we've seen that before, right? Where he supports people. And so here you have Donald Trump is in there. He is screwing up the politics. People don't know which direction to go to in the Republican Party. And the bottom line is Donald Trump is a great motivator for Democratic voters. I wish people would get more excited at the prospect of a multi-trillion dollar infrastructure bill. I wish people would get more excited at the notion of, like, you know, particularly with the final, COVID bill, but all of the COVID relief things had a dramatic effect on poverty in this country, both extreme and marginal poverty. But I saw a report in the New York Times this week reporting where people were like, yeah, well, I got the money, but I've seen other people and the way they spent it is wrong. And we shouldn't be. And the point is that maybe in a different context, it would be different. But people don't necessarily respond to material benefits in the way that I think you and I and others might hope that they would in terms of electing. There's still a sort of like a mass psychosis in this country about stuff like that. But what they do respond to is negative partisanship. And that's why Donald Trump was so successful. He is the king of the put down, but he also motivates Democratic voters. I mean, how is this all going to play out? This is like this stew.
Well, it's very interesting, but I think the Democrats understand this. And I wasn't sure that they would, because we were hearing a lot of talk about how we're not going to engage. We're just going to, we've got kitchen table issues and that's what people care about, blah, blah, blah. And I think they have to, you know, I mean, they have to deliver at least some of what they've promised. I mean, that goes without saying. And it's the right thing to do anyway, whether people appreciate it or not, you still have to do it.
Exactly.
And I think there is a sort of overall sort of generalized benefit to the Democrats when that happens. And, you know, the economy, if it's doing well and people are working and all that, the party in power benefits from that. But you're absolutely right about this negative partisanship. And in fact, in the studies that came out after the election of 2020 and 2018, what they found out was that Democrats were highly, highly motivated by negative partisanship. They were motivated by Donald Trump. It was hugely important. And it was a certain group of people. It was people who had not voted before. It is a group of people that were not engaged in politics, but this somehow, you know, Trump was beyond the pale for them. They came out in 2018, and people weren't sure if they were going to come out in 2020 again. You know, was it just that first, you know, big rush of, you know, loathing that they felt, and then they'd go back to their apathetic ways? But they did come out in 2020. If the Democrats can hang on to that group, that is a group that could make the difference in these races around the country and in places where, you know, the Republicans have a lot more senators up for reelection. Democrats aren't retiring the way that the Republicans were in 2020. I mean, there's a chance that they could defy the midterm curse.
Right.
Of the party, because there are these things and because of what you're talking about, because Donald Trump won't go away. It's like that whole thing. You know, how can we miss you if you won't go away? And you can hear it from all these Republicans. I mean, there was I caught a thing, and I wrote about this in my piece for Salon, caught an exchange with John Thune, very powerful Republican in the leadership in the Senate, going, well, we'd like to talk about the future, meaning we'd like to talk about Joe Biden, but apparently we're going to be talking about the past. And he was just basically despondent over the fact. And you can, and obviously, I mean, they would like for Donald Trump to at least, you know, hang back, shut up for a little while, let them build some kind of a case for getting rid of Biden. But he will not let it happen. He's a glutton for the attention, and they can't get rid of him. And this is something that the Democrats apparently have decided that they are going to help along. And so they're doing the January 6th. And I think they're, you know, yes, there was a lot of hyperbole. I could have done without some of the crying. I thought that maybe it may have been a bit much. But actually, it was, you know, Republican Adam Kinzinger who was really weeping up there. But, you know, for the most part, it sounds like they're going to do a serious thing. But what it does is it keeps Trump, it keeps January 6th, it keeps that on people's minds. And I think they're going to, you know, they have all the names and addresses of all those people who voted in 2020, and they know who they are, the people who were voting against Donald Trump. And they're going to keep, they're going to let them know that Trump is still out there. They're not going to be allowed to forget it either.
Yep. So, I mean, I think this is, you know, and again, the reason why there's such consistency with the party that's out of power, while winning in the off-year elections, is because of this concept of negative partisanship, right? I mean, it's, you know, it may be heightened, but it's certainly not a new concept. And the idea that the Democrats have Donald Trump to run against in an election where he's not on the ballot or even a politician, you know, an elected politician, it would be political malpractice not to exploit that and to frankly encourage it. And, you know, and like you say, I would be upset about it if it weren't the case that they're also seemingly, at least on the road, generally speaking, to passing $4 trillion worth of infrastructure spending. Some of these measures, which I think are going to fundamentally change the perspective of people towards their government. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mentioned that reporting for the New York Times about, you know, and you can always find people who are going to say those type of things. And it's hard to know how much of that sentiment actually exists. But if it does exist, and some of the data suggests that it might, that you don't see people vote necessarily so readily on their, you know, the material benefits that are given to them. It's also, I wonder if it's not different when those material benefits have been given to them for a sustained period of time. Mm-hmm. And that people develop new ideas without even being conscious of it in terms of what government's supposed to do. And so I think these things politically pay a dividend to Democrats long term, like Social Security has, like Medicare has.
Absolutely.
Maybe not necessarily short term, but there doesn't seem to be any detriment in the way that Republicans in the past have exploited it. In other words, people like, broadly speaking, the ACA now. I think they would like it to go further. Without a doubt, I certainly would. In fact, I would like to get rid of the ACA, at least the exchanges, and go to Medicare for All. But it's harder to dislodge now. The polling is more favorable now than it was for the first 6 years that it was around. And Republicans made a lot of hay off of that in 2010. They don't seem primed to make any hay off of any of these bills that are about to pass. And frankly, they will impact people far more than the ACA does. And they're far more government spending associated with it, far more taxes associated with it. Like all the things that Republicans used to be animated by in the past aren't happening. In fact, this week, it basically looks like you had 17, I think it was, Republicans vote for cloture on this bipartisan bill, $500 billion worth of new spending, more or less, you know, close to a trillion overall of, you know, so-called infrastructure spending. You know, the details have pretty much been the details of what they've been all along. The revenue, they make up some stuff and say, we're going to get money from, you know, whatever it is, recycling some of our cans, you know, more diligently, whatever it is. And they're about to pass that. Kristen Sinema has sort of put a wrench into the gears, maybe with the reconciliation. We have to see how serious that is. But there doesn't seem to be any Republican message against this $4 trillion of spending, which is just stunning. It's stunning.
It's amazing. Another thing I couldn't have predicted 10 years ago, that they wouldn't have mustered some kind of reaction to that. But, you know, I mean, it's there, but it's just kind of all over the place. And, you know, one person says one thing, one says another. There's no central message. And here's part of the problem. Again, it's Donald Trump. Donald Trump ran on infrastructure, just like he ran on getting out of Afghanistan. He didn't do either one of those things. Joe Biden is doing it. So, I mean, they are flummoxed on how exactly they're going to do it. I mean, they can come out and say whatever they want, but even they know, even the shamelessness of the Republicans doesn't go so far as to say that, you know, oh, we were for it. You know, they were for it before they were against it, right? Which is what they ran against with John Kerry, you know, the whole flip-flopping thing. This is where they're at. He overturned their entire sort of, you know, the book that they used, the notebook that they used of all of their kind of template that they had for every kind of talking point. He just threw it all, you know, up in the air, and they don't know what to do. So then the fact that he won't go away, if he'd go away, they could start to, you know, kind of push him away, kind of, yeah, well, that right. was Trump and he had his good points, you know, blah, blah, blah. But he won't go away. So he reminds everybody every day, you know, I mean, infrastructure, what he comes out the night before they got this deal this week and says, don't vote for the infrastructure bill. You know, what? Right. You're the guy who wanted to do it, you know.
Right. And that's not Trump's core brand proposition. You know, getting, you know, policy prescriptions from Donald Trump is right. not. And so there's a fascinating dynamic where Democrats are going to provide material benefit. They are going to essentially create, I mean, I don't know how to really refer to this. Like, I haven't quite, you know, this is something that we've seen the Republicans do in the past, right? I mean, when I just remember doing radio in 2004 and five, maybe into six even, and getting calls from right wingers. And it was literally like we would, you know, we had audio memes of this. It was all Clinton, 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 Clinton. They were talking about Bill Clinton, who hadn't been president for 4 or 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
And, or, you know, at this point. And they were still running against him in some mm-hmm. fashion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Democrats never do that. I mean, you know, Barack Obama got up and was like, you know, George Bush, We're gonna turn the page, and right. they should have been talking about George Bush for the next. We should still be talking about George Bush, and we wouldn't be up here lionizing this guy just because, you know, Donald Trump crapped all over his brother. So the fact is, the Democrats have this gift
yes.
that, you know, that all they really need to do is sort of bank shot it with this January 6th thing, which is all, you know, mm-hmm. the subtext is all Donald Trump and Donald Trumpists and anybody associated with Donald Trump. And they've been given this gift and they're exploiting it. And it is, frankly, it's encouraging to see them politic in this way. There are many things I have problems with the Democrats in terms of like what they're doing in terms of policy. Again, we'll see what happens with that $3.5 trillion bill. But, you know, I would like to have seen within that bill, you know, an expansion of the age or a drop in the age of Medicare. I don't think we're going to in the reconciliation. It remains to be seen. But, you know, largely that's a function of Democratic leadership. Nancy mm-hmm. Pelosi does not want to do that because they don't want to expand the number of people who get Medicare because they're afraid of that getting more popular. But in terms of exploiting the gift they've been giving, you know, they're doing it. And, you know, with some efficiency, it's going to make for a very interesting election, which is only, I should say, you know, 14 months away, 15 months away.
Oh my God.
It's coming quick. But Heather, we will talk more about this in the future. Absolutely. You're off for the next 2 weeks. We will miss you, but we will see you in 3 weeks.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me, Sam.
We know how deadly our for-profit healthcare system in this country has been. In the United States, luckily for Americans, the federal government did subsidize the production of life-saving COVID vaccines. But in the global South, people are less lucky. And that's directly related to Big Pharma's greed. They are essentially holding poorer nations hostage when it comes to vaccine waiver support. Here to talk about this is Sarah Lazar, reporter and web editor at In These Times, which is a great magazine. Her piece on this topic is entitled Big Pharma is Deciding Who Lives and Who Dies in the Global South. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. So let's talk first about what you open your piece with. The president of the Brazilian pharmaceutical trade group, Interpharma, said something shocking a few months ago. It's not shocking in practice, but it's unbelievable to hear it admitted to, because usually these kinds of things are very sanitized. And it's also a useful lens for our discussion. So just talk about what was said.
Right. So last April, the executive president of Interpharma, which is Brazil's big pharmaceutical industry trade group, they represent AstraZeneca, they represent Pfizer, among other pharmaceutical companies, did an interview with the largest newspaper in Brazil, where she really said out loud something that you don't usually hear industry groups publicly say, although it's a big question as to how much they're saying it privately. And what she did was she threatened that if Brazil were to greenlight compulsory licensing for to expand access to COVID-19 vaccines, that the industry might choose to respond by taking its supply of vaccines elsewhere. And I have her exact quote up here. She says, "This is not retaliation. The demand is much bigger than the supply, and they may find it more advantageous from an economic point of view to sell to countries that do not break patents." That's her exact quote.
That's mob boss stuff. As long as she says it's not retaliation, oh, cool, we take your word for it.
Right, right. No implied threat there at all.
She right.
Says, in total good faith. Yeah, and for context, compulsory licensing refers to when a government allows for the production of vaccines without the consent of a patent owner. And she was saying this at a time when Brazil's Senate was floating this as a possibility. The Senate passed a compulsory licensing bill. It could very well be signed into law. But nonetheless, this is an example of the kind of climate of intimidation that is really, really horrific. The day that she made those remarks, Brazil was facing a huge spike in COVID cases. Brazil has really been one of the countries at the epicenter of the pandemic. Its spread of COVID has been so out of control and so severe that it spawned the gamma variant. So it's really important to sit with this reality for a moment, which is that this is the pharmaceutical industry using its control over life-saving vaccines that determine if a huge swath of a country's population lives or dies, and using that to influence the decisions of government.
Right. And I just want to say, like, you mentioned AstraZeneca, I'm not sure, but they also represent Pfizer, Interpharma, right, which is just an unbelievable, I think, admission. And let's talk about these compulsory licensing provisions and laws that are being considered, because there's kind of two tracks here by which these pharmaceutical companies could lose profits. Let me emphasize, they were subsidized heavily by governments to gain a ton of profit, and the executives got very rich at Pfizer, and then BioNTech and Moderna and J&J, even though there's problems with the vaccine now, or maybe not comparatively to the others, they've all gotten very rich. It would just be waiving the patents going forward for one domestically. That's what these compulsory licensing laws would do. And then also it's being considered, but that's been chilling a little bit or cooling down on the international level. So they'd still have made a ton of money leading up to this. This is not stealing back from them. They just would not be making the amount of money that they're making now. So just talk about those two different potential tracks for making these vaccines more widely available, both on the domestic level and the international level.
So, as you said, there are a few ways that governments can break patents for the purpose of dramatically expanding the access of their populations to cheaper generic versions of the vaccine. So there's compulsory licensing, and then there is an effort at the World Trade Organization to basically suspend key global patent rules for the purpose of expanding access to COVID-19 treatments. So the WTO effort was initiated by India and South Africa in October 2020 and has since garnered support from over 100 countries, all the major human rights groups.
We should say that Biden ended up supporting this for the United States, which at least publicly, right?
Yeah. The Biden administration on May 5th made an announcement that was surprising to some, really indicating that he no longer plans to continue what the Trump administration did, which was block the proposal. The extent to which he's willing to actually fight for it is a big open question. There are many activists who want him to be pushing harder. It's important to note that Biden recently met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who is one of the biggest, probably the biggest obstacle to the waiver at the WTO. And the issue of the TRIPS waiver never even came up. So I think there are a lot of people who wish that Biden wouldn't just do the bare minimum of not blocking the proposal, but would actually push for it. So basically the WTO proposal, what it would do is suspend key patent rules under the TRIPS agreement of the World Trade Organization for the purpose of dramatically expanding access to cheaper generic versions of vaccines. I really liken this to the bare minimum of removing a boot from someone's neck. In reality, what we need to address global vaccine apartheid, it's far, far more. You need really redistribution of wealth and resources and sharing technological know-how and global solidarity on a material level in terms of sharing resources for manufacturing and production. So I see TRIPS as extremely important. Sorry, the TRIPS waiver is extremely important, but really the bare minimum.
Right. And so that's on the international level, and that was heating up once Biden in May announced that. But as you say, because BioNTech is located in Germany and did receive, by the way, taxpayer-funded money to develop this vaccine from the German government, Merkel is standing quite firm on not waiving these vaccine patents, which would allow for generic manufacturing of these drugs in countries that are less advantaged. And then you hear, the Bill Gates argument, oh, well, they wouldn't be able to do it correctly. In India, that's one of the top manufacturers of vaccines in the world. It's a completely bigoted argument at best, but really what it is it's a bigoted and a greedy argument. But I digress. On the domestic level, let's bring it back to Brazil with these compulsory licensing measures. So is this kind of a way, one, I have my doubts that Bolsonaro would sign this, right? But two, is this something that's being considered in other countries kind of to get around the World Trade Organization, since you need unanimous consent for among those 100 plus countries for a waiver to happen?
Yeah, there are definitely other countries considering that and pushing for it. I will say that there is a very difficult to quantify climate of intimidation that exists, not only for compulsory licensing rules, but also for political support for the TRIPS waiver at the WTO. So I just wanted to sort of paint a complete picture of what I was able to find domestically with Brazil. So in addition to the Interpharma threat regarding domestic compulsory licensing, there are also reasons to be concerned that fear of industry retaliation is making Brazil reluctant to support a suspension of patent rules on the WTO level. And one of the things I found is that at a May 6th hearing at the Senate Commission on Foreign Affairs, Brazil's foreign minister actually made a statement expressing reluctance to support the TRIPS waiver, and he directly cited concerns that it would affect ongoing negotiations for vaccines. And so I'll just tell you, because we were talking about Biden's position, I'll just tell you what the quote is. This quote was made right after Biden's surprise announcement that he would no longer block the TRIPS waiver. And so this is from Brazil's foreign minister. He said, "We are still analyzing the North American position. Tomorrow, I already have a video conference scheduled with Ambassador Catherine Tai," referring to the US Trade Representative. He then went on to say that it was unclear whether the new US position would create global consensus and whether a TRIPS waiver would actually secure more vaccines. And then this is the key that's really, or the quote that's really key. He said, "Our impression is that most countries will continue to depend on the cooperation of pharmaceutical companies. I think that Brazil cannot stay away from investors and supporters of vaccines, nor affect the negotiation with the one we have here with AstraZeneca and other producers." So that to me is an example of a government official saying that he is hesitant to support a global suspension of patent rules because he's worried that it will affect negotiations and affect and harm the access of people in Brazil who are desperately in need of vaccines. That's a level of intimidation that is really troubling. You know, one of the people that I talked to for the article, Peter Maberduke, who is with Public Citizen, he said that he's not even sure that the company would actually, or that pharmaceutical industry would actually withhold vaccines in response to Brazil taking that political position, because he was sort of like, wherever there's a market, pharmaceutical companies are going to want to sell and there will still be a market. But even that government leaders perceive this to be the case is deeply troubling, and it raises questions about to what extent that fear and that basic power imbalance is affecting other political positions of government.
And it squares with the initial quote that we read, which seems to indicate that, yeah, I will editorialize and say, it seems clear that they are quite afraid of big pharma. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will provide you with examples of other alleged or apparent withholding of medical supplies and drugs by big pharma, which might have informed some of these countries' positions and their fears in this area. We'll be right back. So one of the examples of when big pharma allegedly or seemed to have retaliated against a country happened fairly recently, which is, you know, just if you are just joining us, this is an example of why some countries may be hesitant to support vaccine waivers for patents for these companies so they would lose some profits, but expand vaccine access throughout the global south into poorer countries. They seem to have retaliated in 2007 in an instance that involved HIV meds in Thailand. Tell us about that instance.
Yeah, so unfortunately, this isn't even a case of alleged retaliation. It's pretty clear. So in 2007, Abbott Laboratories, which is based in the US, refused to supply Thailand with a new HIV treatment in direct response to the country's decision to override patent rules on three of the drugs that Abbott produces, among them a cheaper generic version of the HIV treatment, Kalatra. So what Abbott did was it intentionally withheld a new heat stable version of Kalatra. It's heat stable, it's best suited for hot, muggy climates like you will find in Thailand. And the company was actually explicit about its intention, which was punishment and retaliation.
I was trying to give like some sort of legal protection for us, but I guess if they're admitting it, then there we go.
Well, I'm no lawyer, but journalistically, it feels pretty apparent. So this is the quote, and I'll give it a read. So this is from the director for Abbott's public affairs, quoted in the Financial Times, who said, "This is a consequence directly of the Thai government's decision not to support innovation by breaking the patents of numerous medicines."
So just interchange innovation with our money. Right. Not to support our profits, our money. That's unreal.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. You know, pharmaceutical companies use these lofty words like innovation and, you know, hearken to their own personal genius that spawned through this global patent system. But really what they're talking about is protecting their profits. And also, especially in the case of the COVID-19 vaccine, they're using publicly funded research. I do want to say that after global outcry, Abbott was forced to reverse its decision a few weeks later. But unfortunately, this really isn't an isolated case. And we're in a global system where private for-profit entities have control over who gets access to life-saving medicines, whether it's HIV treatments, whether it's hepatitis C treatments, or whether it's COVID-19 treatments. Especially during a situation of a global pandemic, but really always, this creates an incredible power imbalance that's just a recipe for extortion, because governments are desperate to provide for their own people. And people in those countries, their lives depend on their access to these drugs. And so what we're seeing during COVID-19 is an escalation of a dynamic that has really been present ever since the global patent rules were cemented. I should note that those rules are relatively recent. There's nothing natural or inevitable about those rules. A lot of the same pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer that are making huge profits from the coronavirus pandemic also had a really big hand in creating those rules in the first place under the TRIPS agreement at the WTO.
Right. And I mean, I when was the TRIPS agreement, by the way?
So that was 94.
Well, I mean, that's like a perfect crescendo in the rise of neoliberal capitalism, right? Like, I mean, is there anything more indicative of that dynamic than global drug patents like that? And for people who may still be skeptical, Li Fong of The Intercept, you cited in your piece, his reporting from earlier this year, that these industry trade groups for Big Pharma were trying to get the Biden administration to retaliate against nations that were seeking some of these vaccine waivers.
Yeah, so pharmaceutical companies were petitioning the Biden administration to pass sanctions on countries that the industry viewed as a threat to patents. There are really a number of ways that the pharmaceutical industry retaliates. So one thing to note is that the two examples I gave in my piece of this climate of intimidation, I really believe are just the tip of the iceberg. We really don't know what is happening behind closed doors. We also don't know a lot about what's going into the contracts that are being struck between countries and pharmaceutical companies. They're mostly shrouded in secrecy. There's a real lack of transparency. But there was a really great piece at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism looking at how pharmaceutical companies were extorting countries, particularly in Latin America, asking them to put up sovereign assets as collateral. We can also look at other of the pharmaceutical industry's own admissions. It's rare to find an explicit threat like the one Interpharma made to the Brazilian press, but all the time you'll see trade industry groups say, well, if you're going to get rid of patent rules, then we just won't put resources into R&D next time. And when, you know, they're so good at saying that in a way that sounds non-threatening or reasonable, like, oh,
sanitized, right?
Yeah, right. That's exactly the word that I was looking for. Thank you. But when you really stop to think about that, it's just so incredible that these are the entities that we're relying on to save the lives of millions and millions of people, entities that say, if you cut into our profits even a little bit, we won't try to find the next vaccine or the next life-saving drug. I mean, what a sociopathic framework, what a politics of death. One of the people I interviewed for the article, Asia Russell, talked about the drug industry as a cartel. And I think that that's actually a really useful framework because all of the companies are conspiring to promote this framework that is just so lethal and that is really creating the system of global vaccine apartheid where entire areas of the world are just literally being left to die.
Right. And I mean, you mentioned, I just want to bring it back to Latin America, I guess, because the hesitancy to fully back these vaccine waivers isn't, you know, just reserved to Brazil, which is currently, you know, being run by a right-wing demagogue. A lot of this has to do with just complete fear of that retaliation, based on your reporting, how a bunch of countries in South America and Latin America, their systems are a little more threadbare, and so they need to maintain these relationships. So you talk about a cartel, there is a kind of hostage situation that's happening. If you could just explore that dynamic a bit.
Yeah, so it's important to note that Latin America is being really, really hurt by the COVID-19 pandemic. Vaccination rates are very low, and the level of suffering is just very high. The World Health Organization noted that 9 out of 10 of the countries that have recently suffered the highest number of COVID deaths proportionate to their populations were based in either Latin America or the Caribbean. So this is kind of the general framework. And then if you look country by country, the region as a whole has been pretty muted when it comes to supporting the TRIPS waiver at the World Trade Organization. One of the people I talked to, a campaigner for Doctors Without Borders in Brazil, said that it was just more muted than you would expect from the region, especially given how much the Americas are suffering. So just looking at a few of the major countries, Brazil has backed down from its initial hardline opposition to the TRIPS waiver and has been warming up a bit to negotiations, but it's still holding back from full-throated support for the proposal. Only Bolivia and Venezuela formally sponsored the proposal at the World Trade Organization. And then Colombia and Chile have remained reluctant to support the waiver. And then Mexico gave conflicting signals early on. At a speech in May, their president called for the suspension of patents.
And we should note, too, that, you know, Mexico's leader leans left, Bolivia and in Venezuela, obviously, they have leaders that are on the left. And then just in terms of the political scale of some of these requests.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that, you know, they're. It's a little surprising that the only formal sponsors at the World Trade Organization were Bolivia and Venezuela. I mean,
right? No, I just mean like it has to be so politically obvious for the way that those governments are currently constructed for them to put themselves out on a limb like that. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, I think that. So we have those that one example from Interpharma of an explicit threat, but there are also implied threats all over the place. I mean, the fact that these countries are negotiating directly with the entities that have the power to determine whether a huge chunk of their population lives or dies is just an implied threat. It creates a climate where you're afraid to say something that the pharmaceutical industry isn't going to like. And even if that pharmaceutical industry doesn't retaliate, even if they're bluffing, if they threaten that they're going to take their supply elsewhere, just the perception of that danger or that possibility, you know, it's very concerning to see any example at all of that changing the behavior of a politician.
Right. I mean, we talk about the rise of multinational corporations and the decline of the power of nation states. Like, is there a more salient and stark example than what you just described? I'm not sure there is, honestly. But anyway, I want to thank you so much for your time, Sarah Lazar, She's a reporter and web editor at In These Times magazine, and her piece on this topic is called Big Pharma is Deciding Who Lives and Who Dies in the Global South. Sarah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's Ring of Fire podcast. Hey, if you're listening to the free show right now, you're missing all the bonus content our members enjoy on a weekly basis. Go to ROFpodcast.com now and become a member. It's your support that keeps us moving forward. On behalf of Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. Have a great weekend.